Hey, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of the Proud to Work in Cannabis podcast. We are coming to you live from Las Vegas, Nevada, MJ BizCon, and finally, I have Jason Wild, chairman of TerrAscend. We've been trying to do this for about 5 years, and now we're here.
Right.
Five cannabis years.
Which is like a year or something normal.
Well, thank you for finally doing it.
Thank you. And I'm sorry for all the blown and rescheduled things we've had to do over the last year.
Well, the good news is that now we get to do a live one. This is our second live podcast ever, so I feel like it was kind of meant to be.
Yeah, but even here, I got here a half an hour late, so we can only do a half an hour.
Well, let's get going then. So, Jason, you have an incredible entrepreneurial story. I absolutely love entrepreneurs, being an entrepreneur myself, so some people like you are super inspiring to me. Mm-hmm. And I feel like people really only see you as the chairman of this large publicly traded company. Can you take us back to how you got your career started and the path that you went down? Because it wasn't the same as everybody else's.
Yeah, it wasn't the normal path. Absolutely. I mean, I always grew up like entrepreneurial. I remember like when I was in like ninth grade trying to figure out I was going to like sell lollipops in school or something like that. And my father's an entrepreneur as well. And he's a pharmacist and he had a bunch of drug stores when I was growing up. And I would bounce all these ideas off of him. And then I came to him with an idea when I was a senior in high school. I lived in Rockland County, which is a suburb of New York, and none of the restaurants delivered, like zero. There were, you know, multiple pizza places and Chinese restaurants and all that. None of them delivered, and I was like, people want to get the, everyone doesn't want to have to go drive in and get the stuff. I'm going to go, I think I can go make a deal with these restaurants, say, I'll take care of the delivery for you. So if you get any orders that come inbound on your numbers, you refer them to us, but also we're going to generate business for you. And I worked out a deal. They gave us like 15% of the check or 18% of the check. And then we also got like a delivery fee. And we were essentially like Uber Eats or DoorDash or something. Way ahead of, this is 1989.
Yes.
And the crazy thing is,
the DoorDash of 1989.
Right. There weren't even cell phones. Or we didn't, you know, maybe it was like, you know, $100 a minute or something like that if people had them. So we had to have all of our delivery people like, after they made the delivery, go back into town and call us. So we would give them a roll of quarters. And if they got lost, there wasn't MapQuest or
no,
you know,
way to know where they were.
Nothing. We didn't, you know, there was no navigation or anything like that. So I would have delivery guys sometimes, they'd get lost for like an hour and a half, 2 hours, you know, and at the same time, we're getting annoyed. It was very, it was difficult, but I feel like that sort of set me up for the cannabis industry where you got a million different variables coming at you all the time. And you got to sort of like, you know, I look at it as like, you know, there's a million balls coming at you. You got to like take them and put them in the right place. And everybody else is dealing with the same stuff generally that you are. So you just got to, you know, you can't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. And you just got to roll with it and do the best you can.
So that was when you were a senior. Then you went to the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
Right.
And then talk to us about, you know, it's your senior year of college. How do you decide what you want to do when you get out of school?
Yes.
So like that's a moment in time for people where, you know, there's so much pressure on people. Mm-hmm. They're seniors in college. Like, what was going through your head about what you wanted to do with your career at that time?
Totally. And even the pressure I just put on myself, I'm like, you know, what do I want to do? What, you know, do I want to, is, do I want to get into health? You know, I was thinking about getting into healthcare. My father, like, as I mentioned, my father's a pharmacist. I was pre-med. Mm. So, but I am not a strong student. I mean, I was always the person who did as little work as possible,
right,
and generally did okay. Often with the help of some friends in high school, you know, like...
You paid them from your business.
Yeah, no.
I thought A students teach B students how to work for C students.
Okay. Oh, that's a variation on the... usually it's just the A students work for the B students. I like that, though.
Well, let's add
that's
in better. The C one, because
yeah,
as a C student, I want
to... I was a C student. Yeah. So I ended up deciding to go to pharmacy school because my dad was like,
right,
you'll come into...
Right.
You know, you'll come help me with the drug stores and we'll be in business. And, like, you know, I love that aspect of it. But by the time I graduated pharmacy school, he had sold the stores because it was impossible to, make money with the insurance companies lowering reimbursement,
right,
and competing with CVS and Walgreens,
right,
and all that. So I graduated pharmacy school. But my last semester of pharmacy school, my roommate had the Peter Lynch books. He was, you know, Peter Lynch ran Fidelity Magellan. He was considered like almost as up there as Warren Buffett, not quite, but, you know, grew Fidelity Magellan from like, you know, millions to billions, amazing stock picker. And his books were all like, buy what you know. Like, if you're a pharmacist, then you should know a lot more than everybody on Wall Street that's investing and controlling a lot of money investing in these drug stocks, but has never worked in a pharmacy or is not a pharmacist, doesn't understand the science. I really took that to heart. I had like 10 grand, largely because I sold that business for 10 grand before
the Uber DoorDash.
Right. It was called Phone for Food.
I like that. Yeah. Phone for Food.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you.
So you had 10 grand.
So 10 grand that I had like in an account, and I started investing it in the stock market. And I realized that, like, and they don't talk about it in the books, but I think people are either built psychologically to be good at picking stocks or they're not. And most people aren't because they're too emotional. And when things are going well, they often they're like, oh man, why don't I own more? You know, they have a complaint about when it goes up, but when it goes down, so many people get so beat up that they end up, you know, buying the highs and selling the lows, which is obviously the opposite of what you're supposed to be doing. But I ended up, I had like 10 grand in an account. I started picking stocks, and then I got my pharmacy degree. This was 1997. And I was so excited. I was making $65,000 a year as a base salary. All my friends who, you know, did not go to pharmacy school, they were like starting salaries like 30 grand. So I felt like I was like rich.
Rich.
And amazingly, I was able to take every other paycheck, post-tax, and deposit in my brokerage account.
To do investing.
To do investing and buying stocks. And I didn't know any better. I was margining everything 2-to-1. So like that works when things are working. And I turned that first year of being a pharmacist, I made 65 grand as a pharmacist, and I made like over 400 grand in
Holy
the stock
cow.
Market on like 25, 30 grand. So I was
like,
I got to do
good
this.
At this.
And I'm bored out of my mind, filling prescriptions. I was working in a mail order facility and filling like it was just a numbers thing. I didn't even get to, you know, I like to talk and socialize and all that. But it was.
You're asking the customers, like, have you seen the stock?
Oh, of course. Yeah. It's funny. It was this big facility and they had a corporate lunchroom. And I remember, it's funny that you say that, I remember being in the lunchroom and like looking for somebody who was interested in talking about the stock market with me, and I couldn't really find anybody.
No, there was no other pharmacist interested in the stock market.
No, not at this place.
Not at this time.
But, and then when I looked at the numbers and all of that, and I remember talking to my dad because halfway into the year, I was like, I'm bored out of my mind. I feel like there's no, I'm supposed to just do the same thing every single day or whatever. And I remember he said to me, that's why they call it a job, which I was like, you know, which I thought was bullshit.
Right.
But and I wasn't going to sort of, you know, fall into, you know, that line of thinking. And I ended up, I saw an ad in the back of Barron's. My dad always got Barron's, you know, the financial weekly.
Yep.
And there was an ad in the back of Barron's towards the end of that first year of me being a pharmacist. And it said, do you want to open a mutual fund or hedge fund? You know, call me. And it was a guy who's a fund administrator. I called him up and he like ran me through everything.
You see it on the back of a, paper basically.
Yeah, back of right. I have the ad by the way.
Oh my gosh.
Because Barron's like interviewed me a few years ago and the
you gotta frame it.
The
something.
Editor went back and found it on like microfiche or
wow.
whatever it is. Yeah,
that's cool.
So, but
you called the number.
I called the number and like he laid it all out for me. Like mutual fund, impossible unless you're raising like $1 billion or whatever it was. I mean, I was like. I had like 80 grand that
right.
I could,
right.
that I was thinking that I was going to start it with, but it cost me 20 grand to open up a hedge fund. It's really just an investment limited partnership. He was going to be my fund administrator, like, you know, settle all the trades that we'd get a conference of all the trades and he'd send out all the statements to everybody. We've now used him for 25 years.
Oh my gosh.
He was charging
probably
me back then like $100 a month or something like that.
Yeah.
And I decided I was going to start the fund and mainly because I believe that my stock picking was going to drive performance. I just felt, and I believed in the, in compounding.
You're like 25 or something at this point?
26.
Yeah, 26.
Yeah, yeah. And what happened was I said, you know, like sort of, if you build it, they will come.
Yep.
I started with 80 grand. It was like 50 grand of mine, 20 grand from my dad and 10 grand from one of my buddies. And I was running it at this point. I was engaged to my beautiful wife and we had an apartment and I was like,
is she
running
like, this
it.
Is crazy.
No, she's always been super like supportive and believed in me. And I was able to do this because she was making enough money to like support us that I could, you know, say I'm giving up this $65,000 a year, you know, job or
pharmacy
most of it. Cause I worked the first couple of years I worked, in the ShopRite pharmacy in Paramus, New Jersey, like two nights a week. Oh. So maybe I was making 20 grand or whatever it was.
Right.
But, and it was really, when I talk to people about the story, if I talk to somebody like who's like my age now or 40 or something, it's sort of like, I can't necessarily encourage them to do something like that because at that point I had such, you know, little expenses. I didn't have kids, you know,
Your burn's low.
Yeah, right. So
I always
think about that.
Like, it's the best, like, I mean, similarly, I started my thing in college and I think about it now, like when I talk to my friends who want to start businesses, I'm like, well, you have like kids and a house and a mortgage. Like, it definitely gets harder as time goes by, which is why I always tell people, like, your 20s are like the time. Like, 100%. Just send it.
Yeah.
Who cares if you mess things up? Because by the way, it doesn't matter. You don't have a, you don't have anything. So there's nothing else to lose.
100%. And
so 20 people in their 20s out there. Now's the moment to send
it. Now's the time.
And I was listening. I love Danny Myers. I just think he's incredible. I was listening to one of his books, and he said he was studying for the LSAT. He was taking the LSAT the next day, but obviously he'd always like wanted to be a chef.
Yeah.
And his uncle said to him, Danny, how many years are you going to be dead? And he was like, I don't know. And his uncle said, well, you're going to be dead a hell of a lot longer than you're going to be alive. So why the fuck are you taking the LSAT when you want to go and be a chef? And he went on to open a ton of amazing restaurants, Shake Shack, you know. Mm. And it's just like, I love that you were like, I'm filling prescriptions. Why am I filling prescriptions when I can be doing something I love? So anyway, I want to get back to your
and
story.
And I have ADHD.
You have ADHD.
So it was undiagnosed, but it was like,
this podcast could be hard because we both have ADHD, but I feel like I'm doing a good job.
Yeah, let's change subjects and talk about something else. What's going on out there? I'm just kidding. So it was...
So you start out, you got basically 100 grand. Some of your families, your wife's working.
She's working, and I was running it like out of my one-bedroom apartment in Midtown Manhattan.
Yeah.
And somebody introduced me to another guy he knew that had a fund. I went over, the office was three blocks away. It was like a hedge fund hotel
with
multiple funds. And the guy liked having me around, and he just started showing up there every day.
Your office.
It was like, you know, there's a Seinfeld where Kramer showed up for the job that he wasn't hired for. And that's what happened. I started showing up there every day. And after like 2 or 3 weeks, the guy that owns the firm, he's like, well, you're here every day. You might as well run your fund out of here. And
you
we'll also
that,
give you,
no,
it's cool. Zia told me to turn this off before, and I did.
No, we like it.
If
it was Rosie, we would have had to answer.
That's funny. Yeah, for sure, I wasn't. So he was like, and you should trade our prop account, proprietary trading account as well, which was like awesome. I was just trading whatever I was trading in my fund. I was doing it double the size, doing it for this firm, and they paid out monthly in terms of the profits and at 50% payout versus my fund at 20. So that is what, for the next several years, made it so that I could, you know, help support, you know, me and my wife as well, because I was essentially, carrying two jobs at once to a certain extent.
And I think like a takeaway here is like Jason just showed up to these people's office. Like when you show up over and over again, I think eventually good things begin to happen. So fast forward to today, you have $600 million under management, according to the website. Talk to me, like, how did you go from the 100,000 to the 600,000? Obviously, you got a lucky break here, but not even a lucky break, but just you kept putting yourself in the position to get lucky. What was the next several years like as you started really growing the fund?
So it took a while.
And then eventually we will get to cannabis.
Yeah, for sure. It took a while. I mean, the fund went from like 80 grand to by the peak in, the market, the NASDAQ peaked in March or so of 2000. By the way, the same exact day that I got arrested in Central Park for smoking weed. That was the Rudy Giuliani no broken windows policy,
right.
And they were going to go after everything. I went into jail. I was like in jail in downtown 2000, March or April of 2000.
Yep.
It took me like 24 hours to get put through the whole process. And when I finally got out, every single one of my stocks was down. Like that was the peak that day before.
And you didn't know what was going on because you were in jail.
I didn't know what was going on. But,
24 hours.
But it was like a little crazy. Not that I think the whole world revolves around me, but like.
Right.
You know, I sort of, me and the market both sort of crashed at the same time. And over the following, year or so, we built the fund back up, you know, from that peak in 2000. I was definitely much more aggressive back then and had, you know, major volatility. But figure by 4 or 5 years later, we were only up to like, you know, 8 million in AUM. And I was always, I think that this is something that I often tell people who are entrepreneurs, like, to me, one of the biggest aspects about it is just patience. Like, it's not all going to happen
overnight.
Right away. And I don't care. I mean, I'm here, you know, and same thing with cannabis. Like, I'm here for the long term.
Right.
Like, if it takes a year, if it takes 10 years or 20 years, like, it doesn't matter. And that is, I think that's what separates a lot of other, a lot of companies are sort of, they go to reach and try to grab a dollar today because they don't have patience, when if they don't take it today, they can make $5 next year or something like that.
Which I think is a big issue for venture capitalists too, especially like the impatience, right?
And absolutely.
I think, like, when I think about it, everyone seems to think everyone's an overnight success 15 years later, 20 years later. And so I think this story is so good because you're talking about, you know, the first, like, you're talking about, that was like a decade that you just described, and you were still $8 million under management. So I want to keep going with the story.
So we peaked. So by 2010, which was 12 years in, we got
12 years
to,
in.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. Let me back up a little bit. We got up to about $50 million in AUM by 2000, by the beginning of 2008.
Okay.
Then the market crashed.
Right.
And
so
a lot of my
stuff.
This is
your second market crash, basically, in your, in 2008 was your second time going through.
Yes, there were two of them. Yeah, for sure. And generally, you know, we have a major, you know, they always call it like a 1,000-year flood, but it seems to happen in the market. You know, we've had some nice, strong bear markets every, you know, 6 years or so. But got up to $50 million in AUM by the beginning of 08. And by the end of 08, with the combination of, you know, not great performance, you know, down 20-something percent or high 20s percent, and all these other funds put up gates and didn't let people take their money out, and we didn't, because my view was like, I don't want somebody to be stuck in my fund if they don't want to be there.
Right.
But they all came to me for liquidity because they couldn't get it out of other places.
Oh.
I had a lot of investors had money with Bernie Madoff. They got wiped out from that. They had to take money from us. So between all of that, we went from $50 million in AUM to about $12
million
in AUM. And if you look at the history of my fund, that's sort of like we have a big run, and then we have a decent pullback, it consolidated, and then we go on another big one. We ended up going straight from $12 million in AUM to, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars over the next few years.
There's a perfect example. If you would have just been like, you know what, this isn't for me, I've gotten too beat up. If you would have quit you would have never had the success that you ultimately had from just sticking it out and keeping going.
Yeah, absolutely. And just knowing that it's a long game, and not to judge myself too much on whatever is happening in the near term. You know, just sort of believing in what we were doing. But what happened in 08 also was, my real specialty there was what's called specialty pharma companies, which are the smaller ones that aren't Merck and Pfizer. They're often much more entrepreneurial. And I ended up in like 08, I ended up finding two of the public companies I was invested in. I found one company, this amazing deal. They bought an asset from this other company, paid $10 million for it. And they ended up doing like $300 million in revenue. They had a few things their way over there. Yeah, at like an 80% gross margin. And I put that whole thing together. That company wouldn't have gotten it if it wasn't for me.
And that's the one that you're on the board of?
No, this
now?
Is
this is, okay.
This is the genesis of that.
Okay.
So I was like, and I got a pat on the back from them. So, and I was like, you know, it didn't really do anything for my investors and my fund and all of that. And I was like, I got to, whenever I sort of have something where I miss a huge opportunity or squander an opportunity, it makes me feel a little better if I say, okay, that was my education, part of my education. I need to figure out how to not squander that opportunity again.
I always call this a very expensive MBA.
Exactly.
Right? We're both getting very expensive MBAs.
Exactly. So what I'd set out in 09 to do was find a CEO to partner up with, and I wanted to start a drug company because I had so many companies coming through my office, you know, public ones, and they were much more open with me than they would be with, like, competitors if there was like a business development guy at another pharma company. So I could be like, this product doesn't seem to fit with the rest of your portfolio. Would you be willing to sell it and all that? And often, you know, a product that's lost or an orphan within a big company could really be revitalized by a smaller one that puts, you know, some attention behind it. So that was my idea, was I have all these, I can see this deal flow, and I'm good at knowing what are good deals.
Right.
And just knowing, like, if you told me a product, I could easily have a service. I could look up their sales and how many prescriptions they're doing a week. I could figure out their margins. Like, I can usually on the back of the envelope tell you roughly what it would be worth. And I wanted to be able to refer those opportunities in-house. And that was the genesis. It took me about a year to find a CEO to do it with me. And we co-invested in this thing, Arbor Pharmaceuticals.
Right.
We bought a small company called Arbor that was doing like $1.5 million in sales. We bought it for $2.5 million, put another $3 million on the balance sheet. The CEO put $1 million of his own money in the company, which I thought was admirable, and also said he wasn't taking any salary until we were cash flow positive, which was crazy at the time because we didn't have anything. We were starting from scratch. And we ended up, we did that in April of 10, and we found three amazing deals that first year, required like practically no cash up front, where the next year we were doing $127 million in sales and $55 million in pre-tax profits.
And so it next worked year, out for the numbers.
Yeah, three years later, we're doing $100 million in profit, and KKR, the big private equity fund, came knocking. We sold them a third of the company. We sold them all secondary shares. So I was able to go to all my investors and say, you know, you can KKR will buy every share that you'll sell them at 150 times what you paid for originally. They were happy, and it took my fund, you know, to the next level from 20 something million, which is what I had gotten it back to.
And this was in 2013, you said?
We sold to KKR that piece in 15. So 14 or 15.
So this was like a huge break, but this, again, to like the 15 years later, this was like 15 years later?
What's the saying about like all these years to become an overnight success or something?
Right.
And it like, you know, it took my fund up. I mean, this company was earning $100 million. If you conservatively market, even if, you know, for what we kept on our portfolio, that's worth $800 million.
Right.
And we owned half of it.
Right.
So, and we raised like, the company raised total equity from inception of $20 million. So that means that all those earnings were massively accretive on an earnings per share basis. And, you know, we invested at 25 cents a share and we sold to KKR at $37 a share.
Wow. So I want to get into cannabis. So now this happens.
So I took that money.
So you took this much. Yeah. So this happens.
You took that money and I put it into
weed. You're like, I'm not done yet. I'm going
into it. Yes. Oh, okay.
It wasn't even a thought
about whether I was done. I mean, even now, like I plan on doing this for,
you
know, stock picking and investing for, you know, for as long as I can.
But 100.
Yeah. 100's cool. Yep. That's good. But what happened was we had my investors cashed out about $150 million in this whole, it was like on $1 million. It became $150 roughly or something
crazy
like that.
Crazy cool.
And I got a call from a banker in Canada saying, hey, did you know they legalized medical cannabis here? And we're raising money for this company up in Toronto. You know, you want to come see? I've been a connoisseur or a consumer of cannabis for, you know, multiple days a week for 20-something years, I guess, at that point, or maybe a little less. But I was like, I'd never seen it grow before or seen live cannabis plants or anything like that. Maybe I planted a couple of seeds, you know, which ended up being males or whatever, you know, in 1992. But I wanted to go see it. I'm always a big believer in going, getting off my butt, not sitting in front of my computer and watching my stocks tick all day. And going
getting out there.
Getting out there, even if it's a company that I don't end up investing in.
That's a good tip, everybody. Get out there.
Get out there. And turn over every, you know, stone that you can in terms of different opportunities, different... you never know what you're going to find. And even if you don't find something you're going to invest in, it might be an opportunity for later, where they come back to you or something changes. Or you just learn and they put you onto, you know, some other company that might be interesting. Like, it's just, I always learn. So that's what happened. We went up. It was this company, Metrum, that ended up becoming part of Canopy Growth.
Yep.
And I went up there and I was like, holy shit, this is going to be huge. I was starting to get... you know, more, you know, worried about pharmaceuticals and and pricing. And the election, you know, the presidential election was coming up, and it was the first time we had a Republican in Donald Trump who was anti-big pharma as well. Usually it was just the Democrats. Yep. And I just felt like cannabis, I considered it healthcare or pharmaceuticals. Mm-hmm. I just felt like it was going to be the only part of pharmaceuticals that I thought was going to grow very strongly over the next 20 years. And when I came back from that trip, I was like, I got to meet as many of these cannabis companies as I can. This is going to be huge. I was even surprised. Like, I was talking to my parents about it. They weren't like, what the fuck's wrong with
you? Were you living in New York or Miami at this time?
I was living in New York.
In New York, okay.
Yeah, yeah. And I was in Armonk in Westchester. So I started going up for 3 years or so. I probably did, you know, 30 trips up to Canada. I would start often on the West Coast and work my way to Toronto. And we ended up investing mainly in four companies.
Okay.
And fortunately, those turned out to be some of the best ones. And even the way we weighted them, we put the most money into the biggest position, and that was Metrum, which was bought by Canopy Growth.
Yep.
And we held on for a few years with that, and we were getting paid like over 20% a year in short interest to lend our shares out. And that did really well. We were like the sixth largest shareholder in Canopy when Constellation invested in
it. Incredible.
You know, what was it, $3 billion or whatever it was. Kronos was our second. We were like ninth largest shareholder in that. So we had invested, roughly $20 million. My view was like, if it works,
it's going to work and have a real impact on the portfolio. And if it doesn't, we'll lose a few percent and it won't be a disaster. It's like, you know, it was just the, I felt like the risk reward from a dollar perspective was good. And we ended up, you know, we put in, we put them that money in, and 2-3 years later, it was worth like over $200 million because all these stocks went crazy.
Yep.
It was before REC in Canada.
Yep.
And in late 17, I was up there at a conference and talking to Bruce Linton, the old CEO of Canopy Growth. And I said, you know, I just met with all my companies and a bunch of other companies. And these guys, these executives, and I said, guy, it was mostly guys.
Right.
There weren't too many females back then in the space in Canada. But I said, they're all the biggest fucking lightweights I've ever met in my life. I said, I think I can do like a Arbor 2.0, but in cannabis. But the difference is, when we started Arbor, our goal was to 100 million in sales within like 5 years, I think.
Yep.
Which, you know, which we beat in the first year. But it was never to be the biggest, you know, most profitable pharma company in the world.
Right.
Just there was so much competition. But I felt like in cannabis there wasn't. And I said, I think we can be a top, you know, 5 or 10 cannabis company in the world within 5 or so years. And Bruce Linton like loved the idea. We had a very good relationship, but he's like, we want to do it with you. So the way that manifested itself was TerrAscend was a company I'd put 500 grand into in January 17. It was now November.
Yep.
And I called them up and said, I want to come by and see you. And I convinced them they had a $50 million market cap. They were trading on the CSE. And I convinced them to take a $52 million private placement. Canopy Growth co-invested in that deal with me. I did 60% of it, and they did like 40%. And that was the start of the whole thing.
At first,
we were only doing Canada. Like, I was worried about getting arrested and all
that.
Yeah,
you didn't want to get arrested again.
No, not again. But within about a year or so, the stock, here's what, you know, what happened. The stock went from a dollar. It was the day before MJ Biz in Vegas in November of 17.
Okay.
We announced it, like we put out the press release the morning, it was like the first day of MJBiz. The stock went from a dollar where it closed, it opened at $2.20, closed at like $1.90. And then over the next 6 months, it went to like $5. And I was freaking out because we hadn't done anything yet. We didn't have any sales.
What's going on here?
And we were looking for deals. We keep getting outbid by other Canadian companies that were willing to, you know, overpay and all of that. And we were being disciplined. And I realized, like, I was stressed because we were being given so much credit at that point, and I was worried that I wasn't going to be able to deliver. And I realized that the only way that I could feel comfortable that we were going to be able to deliver is if we went to the U.S.
Yep.
And that's
you came to the U.S.
And we came to the U.S. We were the first, I think, Canadian LP, or maybe we were the only one that completely pretty much pivoted to the U.S. We gave up the right at the time. We knew we weren't going to be able to list on a U.S. exchange. But like to me, it's the whole, you know, short term, the market's a voting machine, and long term, it's a weighing machine. And we weren't going to be able to build a real business if we didn't go after the biggest market in the world.
And that's how it
started. And
here's the thing. This is actually a two-part episode.
Yeah.
So part two, we're going to talk about how TerrAscend went into the U.S., your strategy in the U.S., what you're predicting for 2024 will be coming to you in part two. So, Jason, thank you so much for coming. I can't wait for part two of this episode.
I'm psyched. I can't wait.
All right, thanks.
Thank you.